And now for the main event. I saw the panelists out in the hall. There wasn't a fist fight going on, but there was some discussion. They're all here, but not in the room. Well, I will say this, that this panel is another one of those where if you through the years keep track of their predictions, they have an amazing batting average, and they'll remind you of that when they come in. But they have, the ability to look around the corner because they're already involved in things that they're going to talk about at very early stages and have a pretty good idea where things are headed. The constituency that makes up this panel has changed only very slightly through the years, but it has changed just a little bit. I'll remind you again, right after this, at 5:30, we're due down at Skadden Arps on Broadway between, 42nd and 43rd? No. Yeah, that's right. 4 Times Square is the address. And as soon as this finishes, we can head that way. We have more PowerPoints. Hey. This panel is going to tell us, these guys run money, and they're going to tell us where they're going to put their money. It's not a bad idea to follow along. Yeah, we're ready. Steve Gittemall rejoins us this morning. His excellent remarks depressed me pretty good. I failed to mention this morning, though, that he was the managing director at Citibank's Tribeca Investments and portfolio manager for their distressed investing portfolio. And he also was prominent back then in the Caldor case and Musicland and some others. Leon Frankel is on all kinds of committees. You get him on the phone on these conference calls, and he always has a different outlook. And he's usually right. He has a master's degree in engineering from Kiev University, and that isn't in Corpus Christi. Yes, you will find out. He has a super experience, 33 years in bankruptcies and reorganizations, and has a major say at Triage Capital Management, which he formed, in the outcome and the reorganization of many major U.S. corporations. Ken Grossman is with Signature Group Holdings. Signature, in case you're keeping score, is the former Fremont General Corporation, which emerged from Chapter 11 in 2010 with over $100 million in liquidity and substantial tax attributes. Prior to undertaking that gig, he was a managing director at Ramos LLC, which was a $3 billion strategy fund where he managed $300 million in distressed debt. He also served on the board of trust directors of eLottery. He was a chairman there. Evercom Systems, Texas New Mexico Power, and chairman of Roberts Consolidated Industries. So he takes an active role when he takes over. Gary Hines is the chairman and managing member of the Delaware Bay Company. Delaware Bay is something that he has fostered from infancy. He served as chairman of creditors committees such as McLean Industries, a member of the creditors committee also in Circle Express and the Western Union bankruptcy. He served on the ad hoc committee of bondholders for LTV in bankruptcy and was chairman of the bondholders protective committee during the John Mansfield bankruptcy. I know him best as the chairman of the Meritor bondholder committee and that home run. David Miller is a portfolio manager with Elliott Management Corporation, who kneecapped country of, is it Argentina?
That's right.
Argentina. So, and but he had preparation for that role by being a at Peter Solomon, and he is currently a director of JCIM LLC, which is an automotive component supply joint venture with Johnson Controls. And he is a former director of a company I'm familiar with, known as the Sim Group Energy Partners GP. That was a general partner of the, was it MLP or an LP?
MLP.
You can't lose money on those MLPs. Okay, take it away.
Thanks, Hugh. Okay, so what we do every year is we sort of talk about our kind of views on particular bonds or stocks that we're sort of looking at in the industry. But like all good investors, we kind of like we start with the discipline of, you know, what's your point of view and what do you think about the market in general? Because, you know, as we've all probably learned the hard way, is that when you want to go long, even into good situations in a collapsing market, that usually doesn't work out so well. And usually, if you even buy lousy stuff in really good markets, you can often do well. So we'll start with a beginning of sort of an overall macro framework. And I would just give the panel two questions. This morning we talked a little bit about the QE2 easing and the low interest rate levels that we are right now. And maybe we can just sort of get a general discussion of how do you see the economy going forward for next year, 2013? And, you know, do you have any sort of views on the QE2 easing and where that may take us from an interest rate standpoint? And why don't I start, Leon, you're right to my right here. Let me start with you, if that's okay.
Okay. So what's the question?
The overall economy,
okay.
What the Fed's doing right now.
Okay. Disclaimer is that I'm not responsible if anything happened the way I not discuss it. So the economy is okay. Always the economy comes to the level with consumption is levels and not going to grow. And as you can see, we are not going down and we are not going up. The changing of Federal Reserve head will really, in my opinion, take the direction. It was kind of some way political, and if it will become even more political, you will have Q3 and 4 and 5 and all the ships in the ocean because they cannot lose the economy. And there is nothing to lose. The only what will happen is going to be more government involvement in every other aspect of your life because now there is a green light for anything to do except the structure of Washington is such that you have a triangle of power, and it may work and may not. So the economy is going to be kind of flat. The growth, in my opinion, of 3 or 4% or all kind of nonsense people talking about because of international involvement with China and Europe and everything else. Who is going to consume everything produced at 0.5% interest rate? Who is to consume everything we're doing? the capacities are going to grow because banks will have to lend money, and the people who build have to build, and maybe they come. So there's a status quo in the economy, except market will go up and down 500 points either way, one day or 2 days, and then come back. What else?
Interest rates.
Interest rate.
So the QE2 easing doesn't really bother you? You say no matter, even though they're doing it, it's going to be okay?
Because it's taking the same medicine all the time, and the patient is still sick, so what's the difference? It's not going to go right away to 4%. Okay, but everybody projects and wants to get rid of $16 trillion of debt by growing the business. If you look at the world economy and countries, everybody rushes to the bottom because they want their currency to be the lowest in the world. What kind of race is that? So the world never seen this kind of conditions. That's my opinion. I'm not an economist. World never seen these conditions. They don't know the cure to this. And everybody refers to tax rate with Reagan and everything else, but they're forgetting a lot of things. Number one, when Reagan came to power, interest rate was 18%, and we are at 0.5%. It's a 36 times difference. So to bring economy up when interest go down, I understand. But to bring economy up and interest rate up, I don't. It's counterintuitive. They destroy the value of money, and now they don't know what to do with it. And the other thing, they're talking about how much tax revenues was brought by Clinton administration, which was a bubble in a technology market and a stock market. Nobody remembers that either. They only know that all of a sudden it was a balanced budget, but they don't know how. They don't want to know how because it was a bubble. And everybody paid an exorbitant amount of taxes, and every company produced enormous amount of all kind of gadget goods and everything else.
Let's have another bubble, man.
Huh?
I said, let's have another bubble like that.
Sure.
I can't wait.
So that's about it, status quo, nothing special, money going to be poured into the system if needed. And that's about it.
Kenny?
Sure, thanks, Steve. So a lot of what we've seen on the news the last few weeks, really since the election, is how we're going to deal with what's happening on January 1st. And, you know, there's this push and pull between spending and entitlements on the one hand and revenue and taxes on the other. I think that is a key area in this country to keep an eye on, and I don't think it's going to get resolved all that quickly. Certainly not by the end of next month. I've come to believe that you can't rely on what you hear from almost any political source on economics, whether it's principally the BRIC countries and China that I'm talking about. So, and I'm gonna be a little bit of a Renaissance person here and sort of hark back to a different America. Watch what happens in Europe. I've frankly been amazed that the southern European countries have been able to maintain as much social stability and, frankly, social peace as they have. And I think that the real surprise on the downside in the next year or two may come out of those European economies. And where this is all going is that if you look at the people this group deals with, I know half a dozen portfolio managers, and that's just in my little world, who have moved to Europe, mostly to London, a few to Geneva. The anticipation of tremendous financial stress and assets being sold under constrained conditions you know, in Europe is really palpable for about the last year.
Kenny, you're saying they move there because of it's undervalued? Is that what you're
no,
saying?
No, I think they're hoping it becomes undervalued. The opportunity for distress selling is pretty significant. So I think if I had to boil down sort of my macro views at the moment, it would be to keep an eye across the Atlantic.
What does that mean? Keeping an eye across the Atlantic, meaning like for an implosion or for a recovery or
for an implosion?
Implosion. Oh, okay. Who's next, Gary?
Well, you know, when I was here last year, I said that the thing that people weren't looking out for was good times. And when I was here last year, and as I used to say when we used to have portfolio managers up at the top of Rockefeller Center, at the Rockefeller Center Club, and even in good times, I'd listen to people at some of the panel discussions and luncheons we'd go to, and even in good times, I used to end the luncheon by saying, you know, I'm just glad that these windows are sealed shut. I think, and I said this last year, and I heard a lot last year that this by now we were going to be in a Great Depression and everything else. I think people are not preparing for better times, and I think that everyone needs to think outside the box and get ready, because we have a number. We all know about the problems, all right? Everybody knows what they are. But we have a number of advantages that people just don't seem to be paying attention to. And I remember last year somebody talking about that, you know, within 2 or 3 years we're going to be energy independent in this country. And lo and behold, the numbers just came out in the last week or so. And, you know, within 3 to 5 years we will be. That's an incredible boon that nobody seems to be factoring into their equations. The fiscal cliff, everybody's, you know, going crazy about it, but it's going to be fixed, and it'll be fixed probably along the lines of either Simpson-Bowles and or the, quote, grand bargain that Obama and Boehner almost struck last year. It's going to be fixed because it has to be fixed, and everybody knows it has to be fixed, and that's why, frankly, you don't see markets, going off the deep end. The market's telling you the same thing. I mean, look what the market, you know, sees things well in advance. And I think that if they get a fiscal deal fixed in place, and they will, get ready for low interest rates for 10 years. Because there's, when you think about it, I know all the theories about, you know, deficit spending, et cetera, all of which have turned out not to be right, at least not for the last 10 years. You're going to see consistently low interest rates for many, many years going forward. That is incredibly bullish for everything, unless you're, of course, relying on it for your savings. But most of the world is not. And I think that if they get a fiscal cliff deal done, if I were them, I presume somebody in the Treasury Department's thinking this way, government needs to issue some 100-year paper at these rates.
Well, that's for sure.
Yeah, they need to be, right. But I was asked by a very senior administration official a couple weeks ago, well, do you think there's a market for that? I said, well, get your deal done, and yes, there will be a market for that.
The problem is they can't, because if they do, the deficit grows further. They can't afford to give up 50 bips.
Well, you can refinance what you have, or a big chunk of what you have.
They absolutely should. But the numbers.
But who's going to buy 100-year paper that they have a percent?
I didn't say it's going to be half a percent. I'm just talking about. I think that if you get a deal done, and the market sees that the United States is serious about its economic house getting it in order, there will be a market for 100-year paper. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is, there are a number of, and then there's housing. Housing is turning around. The multiplier effect in housing is unbelievable. And nobody is focusing on any of the positives. I haven't been, you don't hear people talking about the positives. And by the way, I'm not a 22-year-old kid sitting here who's, I've been through 5 recessions, 2 market crashes. I've got a lot of scar tissue. But people need to be looking for the positives, because that's where the surprise is going to come. It's not going to be any of these other things that you keep hearing about. The surprise is going to be, holy, the population is growing, demand is growing, energy costs are dropping, they're getting a deal done. That's where the surprises are going to come.
And before we go to Dave, let me just say, Gary's also, he's too modest because he's also a very patient investor. He got into Meritor in 1991, if I have the year right, and we just resolved that, I think, at the end of this past year, 2011, so a 20-year investment, which worked out pretty well,
well
for you.
Well, you know, there's the old expression about getting married to your stocks, you know?
Depends on how he bought it.
Actually, I was married to that longer than I was married. I didn't think of it, but yeah, that was 20 years. I was married 18. I got to tell my ex-wife. I said, "Do you know that Meritor?" Which, you know,
that puts the old hedge fund adage on its
hey,
its head, right?
That lasted longer than we did.
Yeah. We date our wives and we marry our bonds. All right? Okay. Well, there we go. Dave Miller.
It's definitely a return on investment. Oh.
Which one?
I agree that there are a lot of positives. You cite gas prices, and that's certainly a huge windfall for the economy, and I think unexpectedly will drive a manufacturing renaissance in the United States, which probably no one would have predicted 5 years ago. You know, interest rates are low, which is good, and demand trends in emerging markets are strong. That being said, I think in the aftermath of this recent election, I think it's very difficult to be bullish about the economy. I think you have a president coming in who, for a second term, who's sort of guiding the economic principle and really policy principle in general is redistribution, and that's something that is very disruptive to markets and to economic growth and even further stifles and retards economic growth. And I think being a second-term president, he's likely to be fairly aggressive in the first year to 2 years of his term, and I think what you're going to likely see is a very rapid move to do a lot of things that the market's really probably not going to like. I would argue it will not likely be good for the economy either. I don't share Gary's optimism regarding the fiscal cliff. I do think that they will do something to patch things up by year end and reach some sort of consensus on some of the less politically charged issues, perhaps relating to unemployment benefit programs and the like, but I don't think you'll see a sufficient or necessary grand bargain on the core issues because you've got two sides, each of which feels like they have a mandate after this election. You know, clearly Obama feels like he has a mandate for obvious reasons, and yet you have the House Republicans claiming that they have a mandate because they were elected to a majority in the House to basically stop all of the things that Obama wants to do. In the work that we've done, sort of canvassing people around the Hill, we find consistently that there's optimism on both sides of the aisle that, oh, of course we'll get a deal done. But when you ask them why they're so optimistic, the answer generally sounds something like, you know, well, the other side has too much to lose and they'll see that, you know, what we're proposing makes sense. And so I don't see, you know, by year end you know, a serious fix for the core issues. I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but I don't expect it to happen, and I think that there's even a chance that between here and there that the market is a pretty scary place, you know, as people with more optimistic hopes, you know, are disappointed that you know, we can't get something bigger done. And in many cases, what we've seen in the last several years out of Washington is that they don't do anything at all until the market puts a gun to their head. So I'd be fairly bearish on the economy and the market in the near term.
Thanks, Dave. Why don't we jump to some of the... you have a comment? Yeah. Sorry.
You know, it's very interesting to listen to all of us, and you really understand that the name of this conference is Distressed Investing. So you all know the debt to cash flow for United States. So where do you think this whole country belongs? High yield, distressed, or AAA? It's up to you to decide because you kind of know about it. And talking about positive things, the only positive things about this country, it's a great country, no question about it. We have reserve currency, so we can print as much money as we want. And that's what will bail us out maybe in the end. I don't know when.
So just one comment on that. The market has already made that decision. The market says we're AAA, whether it's been awarded that by Moody's or Standard & Poor's or not.
And I would say it is trading at AAA. Whether Moody's says that or not, I would agree with you on that. The rates are, the 10 years are at 180 or whatever it is right now, which is incredible.
Who cares about this letter? What's A, triple B, triple C? It's the debt to cash flow. That's what matters.
Yeah, I know, but the market seems to ignore it for reasons that are inexplicable.
The market
doesn't
care until it does. I mean, I think typically what happens with these things is that it takes much longer than anyone thinks for something to unravel, and then it happens more quickly than anyone thinks.
And then the bonds going from 100 to 65 and 70 stays there for about 3 months, and everybody thinks that this is done deal and the corporation is good. But then all of a sudden the next trade is at 40. And then they hire advisors.
You're suggesting that the debt of the United States is going to go from 100, then 65, and next is 45.
No.
If I were Mitt Romney, I'd say I'll make you a $10,000 bet on that, but I'm not Mitt Romney.
No, I'm not talking about the price of the U.S. bonds. I'm talking the regular corporation who has distress.
Well, that's true. Regular
and how it goes, to 80, and then to 60, and then the next trade at 25 or 30.
Zero.
Right, let's talk about a bond that did. Let's talk about a bond that did go from 100 to 65 to 20, and now is at 11. Kodak? Kenny, you want to start us
sure.
on that? And do you want that? I have that one slide. I could put that up if you want to do that.
Sure.
Kodak has been an issue. We're trying to find things that most guys in the room would sort of have a focus on or some knowledge of. Kodak, obviously the great American company, yeah. is in bankruptcy. If we can make that any larger, that's a problem. I could try to talk to some of the numbers. You can't see them really, but it's on the leftmost box. I'll just tee this up. It says commercial imaging combined, and they've got a 2012 estimate, which is this year, has a negative EBITDA. EBITDA number one, which is before corporate overhead, is $50 million on revenue of $2.7 billion. And EBITDA two, which is after corporate overhead, is negative $216 million. And then by 2014, the EBITDA one is like $470 million under management's projections, and EBITDA number two is $304 million. And these three, the other three boxes to the right all sort of filter in and make that make those numbers. And the top box is Digital Printing Enterprise, which is going to be up for sale. In the middle is Graphics, Entertainment, and Commercial Films. They're not going to sell anything there. And then the other units, there's some units there that are going to be sold. That's Brand Licensing and Consumer Inkjet Systems. So with that, maybe...
Can I give this out?
Okay. Well, I wouldn't... you can give it out afterwards. I would just tell us, would you buy these bonds at 11 and then
yes,
why?
Tell us why. The answer is yes.
What are you hearing on the auction, if anything? I mean,
I'm not going to. This is too complex and opaque a story to go into in this forum. But I'm going to try to hit a couple of highlights here. Everybody in the room obviously has an idea of what happened to Kodak. This is a company that relied upon essentially the consumer film business for about 106 years and associated consumer items, cameras, flash bulbs, et cetera. And we all know what happened to that business in the digital era. And the company was extremely slow, perhaps comatose, in reacting to that. And a year ago, they filed bankruptcy. And since they filed the bankruptcy, the news surrounding the company has gone from bad to worse. They had a major loss at the International Trade Commission on a patent case. They were unable fairly recently to roll over the debtor in possession financing, and now there's a bunch of hedge funds that own second lien secured debt who are going to step in and supply that financing and probably have a very big influence on how the company gets reorganized. There's been tremendous criticism of the management both prior and since the bankruptcy. There is a brewing fight over exclusivity. As most of you who are professionals in the area know, it's unusual, 8 or 10 months into a case for a creditors committee or major constituencies to come in and object to the continuation of the exclusive period by the debtor. But there's so little confidence in this management team that's happened already. But the key to this, and I'll leave this handout, which Steve and I have a disagreement over.
It's complicated, that's all. It's just tough in a conference like this, but it's good information.
The complication is really what I want to show everybody. I'm going to hold it up because it looks like a circuit board or someone's MRI for their knee. It is about 50 boxes with about 30 lines on it. And this is what Kodak gave as part of a public filing about 3-4 months ago in order to describe their businesses. And part of the reason I went through sort of the history of Kodak and having, you know, besides the fact that it's a 120-year-old iconic company and it's, just sort of classic that it's now in Chapter 11, is that the businesses and technology that surrounded everything that Kodak did, let's just say in the modern era since, you know, the end of World War II, is actually a $4 or $5 billion business with, let's just say, $500 million of EBITDA. And that's without talking about... thousands and thousands of patents as to which there's speculative, the valuation is speculative. It's without talking about assets that they've accumulated over a century. There's real estate. There are licenses, patent licenses that they own from other people that they acquired, that they're using in their own businesses, et cetera. The point really here is that This is going to turn out to be sort of in a microcosm, an extremely complex Enron, Lehman-like, even Adelphia-like Chapter 11. But at least from where I sit, most of the distressed community hasn't really focused on this. And the reason, I believe, is that there's so much money in the bankruptcy investing world over the last few years, that the senior bonds, and this is public, this is a sort of a publicly discernible fact, were bought up by, I don't know, 8 or 10 very large funds, well-known household names, and there was about a $700 million unsecured class, which, when it traded at 20 cents, and it was valued at $140 million, almost didn't pay for most people to open up a file and try to buy them, because they went from 60 or 70 cents on the dollar to 25 cents, 20 or 25 cents, very, very quickly.
You're talking about the unsecured claims?
These are the unsecured bonds, which are now trading at 10 cents. And those are the bonds that I think are going to end up potentially here being what I guess in our business we call the fulcrum security.
You think they get equity in the new company?
They'll definitely get equity.
And what about the bonds that are trading at 70 that are above those?
I think they'll be reinstated. They'll be reinstated or paid off.
How do they? We have unsecured claims. There are general unsecured claims at Kodak.
Right. They filed with about $300 million.
Yeah, $3 billion, right? Wasn't it $3 billion liabilities subject to?
No, that includes the pensions.
That includes the pensions.
So the pensions are going to be resolved. Pensions are likely to be reinstated. There are not going to be distress terminations. The PBG has already said so, and they already have a deal with the UK pension.
So then why won't all the cash flow go to just paying off the pensions over time?
Well, they have a deal with the UK, which is actually manageable. It's something in the neighborhood of $20 or $30 million a year.
Oh, to pay
over
them
time. And in the U.S., there's actually been a statement by the PBGC that they believe they're very close to fully funded. So there are these are very large claims, but they are able to pay them.
And what do you think the unsecured bonds at 11 could be worth? You know, in a
I'm not even going to speculate as to whether they're going to be worth the same 11 cents or 100 cents. And part of the reason, Steve, I'm going to contravene your instructions, okay?
I want them to hand that out? Right?
When you all see this later on, all right, there's a list of 50 separate businesses here which are all overlapping and related, all right? They all have to do with different types of commercial photography and imaging, and this is a massively complicated business. This is one of the key issues in a bankruptcy like this, is that the company and its advisors have done a tremendously adept job at keeping that information from the creditor body. And I said before, there have been a lot of problems in this case. One of the problems is that the creditors committee wasn't getting information, and they started to balk about it.
Okay. So you're a buyer of the bonds? Yes. The unsecured, and both really, right? The seniors and the juniors.
Well, I'm really a buyer of the juniors.
But you would buy the seniors too, though.
I think, are trading at 78. I think they're worth par, and they'll get accrued interest.
That's a nice return.
No, absolutely. It just could take a few. Could take a while.
So, Dave, let me ask you about American Airlines. You've been following that, and do you have a view about the rumors are that U.S. Air is going to buy that? It seems like they're pretty good rumors. I mean, is that what you think the end result is for American Airlines, this once great airline?
Yeah, I think it's hard to we're not involved in the case, but I have been following it. I think it's hard to envision a scenario where it clearly makes sense for those businesses to be together.
They don't have a lot of overlapping routes. It's a really nice fit, right?
Right. Furthermore, if you're a corporate customer right now, you're either going to use Delta or you're going to use United, because those are the only two airlines that can get you to most of your clients with one connection.
Right.
It makes all the sense in the world for the two companies to come together. It's one of the few industries where, you know, there actually are real revenue synergies. The revenue synergies are almost more reliable than cost synergies. In fact, usually there's a cost dis-synergy in an airline merger. I think right now, just given where the prices of the AMR bonds are, you're probably better served actually to play that prospect of a merger in the equities of the publicly traded carriers, which also would benefit, although they would lose market share from business travelers, to a merged AMR US Air. US Air has been kind of a pricing cockroach in the industry for some period of time. Like, if you go to Orbitz or Kayak, what you'll typically see is that there's some kind of bizarre connecting route that will undercut, you know, the other airlines by 30% on US Air. You will often see that.
You have to stay like 2 days or something, right? Or, you know, it's like three connections. And
But I think bottom line is, you know, given where the AMR bonds are, you're definitely better served, in my opinion, to play it through, you know, buying either Delta or United, which has also been beaten down just due to their own merger integration issues, which have been terrible.
So you think Delta or United will go up if the U.S. Air American Airlines merger occurs?
Almost certainly, yes.
Oh, because we move a competitor and the pricing power comes back. Got it. Right. That's great.
Right. Just to add a little more sort of industry color to that, those comments, the airline segment as a whole is trading, you know, at a cyclical trough as a multiple, somewhere around 3.5 to 3.8 times. And that trough is rather AMR is at the very low end of it. And I think what David said is very true, which is that at the current price of the, whether you buy bonds or you buy claims, you are likely creating the equity at that trough multiple.
Great. I read this as a sort of an aside. I read the other day that Southwest Airlines actually bought a refinery so that they can get lighter crude, so they can like basically take control of their own fuel costs. The airline industry has definitely been one of these industries.
But the margins, the margins in refining, I couldn't figure that out off the top.
No, they just wanted access, so you can also scarf up more of that lighter jet fuel, because as you distill it, you want the sweet crude to give you a better flush of the lighter grades of the engine of the jet fuel, because it really is just properties of chemistry. The lighter stuff floats to the top. And wouldn't that not shock anybody that the lightest stuff is what you want in a jet airline? Makes the most sense. That's what they're running. So Gary had Gary's now about to embark on a legal play, which I think that might interest some of the people in this room. Now, with a caveat, which this is my own Virtus Capital, Steve Gittimall proviso, it may be 20 years till you see an outcome, but.
Oh my God! But it'll be a good one.
But since we'll all live that long, right? And Gary does have connections with Obamacare, so this might also be a reason to become an investor of him.
What company are we talking about?
Well, this is a Penn Treaty, right?
I have a 20-year lifespan in all my.
I see. With that caveat.
Another caveat. I just went on the board of directors of this company, so I don't want people running out and buying the stock. I'll just tell you what I can tell you, which most of the information that I know is publicly available anyway. But Penn, did we talk about this last year, Penn Treaty?
Penn Treaty, we did not.
No,
I was just buying last year. I didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah, the book is 5 cents now. Where is it now?
It was 15 cents, I think, a year ago. It's 75 cents now.
So what does the stress sell?
But anyway, Penn Treaty, symbol PTYA on the pink sheets, used to be PTA on the New York Stock Exchange for many, many years, is an insurance company that specializes in long-term care coverage. They lost their reinsurance during the financial crisis in 2008 and went into voluntary rehabilitation with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, took them over. The company has $1 billion in assets. It has no debt. It has $240 million a year in premium income. It has about $350 million in unfunded future liabilities. So you add all that up, and it's got 20 million shares. But you add that all up, and you say, well, why in the world is this company in receivership, which is what the judge said. The state attempted to liquidate them, and the court in Pennsylvania, for the first time in history, turned down a regulator. When they requested permission to liquidate a company, it said no, go out and get the rate increases that are necessary to restore this company to health and get them back in business. So that's what's going on. The state is working with the company now and the various different state insurance commissioners on a plan to put them back in business. And I don't know how much more than that I can say. Except that I think, obviously, it will work. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone on the board of directors. So.
Gary, let me just add one piece of information procedurally for the assembly, which is that if you go to the company's website, there is a very lengthy judicial opinion which lays out essentially what Gary said, but in obviously tremendous amount of detail. And is one of the few instances that I found in my investing career where there was a judicial decision that basically gave you a very good, investment thesis and process to go by. It's 175 pages. It was written by a judge who I think at one time was counsel to the insurance commissioner of the state of Pennsylvania.
Right.
And it just reeks with indignation coming from her over how the insurance commissioner handled the conservatorship or liquidation, which was voluntary, by the way. The management went to the state and said, we think we're insolvent. I mean, the actuaries are telling us we don't have enough in assets to cover the projected liabilities. As you all can appreciate, I'm sure, you're talking about this was a long-term care company that had, liabilities that were being estimated out 20 and 30 years.
So let me just jump in. So the reason I think it's an interesting thing for – I don't think there's a person in this room who can't read that and understand it. And I also think that in some part of investing, there are what I call two-dimensional situations and three-dimensional situations. Three-dimensional is like maybe what Dave was just talking about, the pricing power. You have to think about back-ending, you know, the pricing power, what the effect is on Delta and United if you want to buy American and how that all works and the fuel. It can get pretty complicated if you're not sort of like thinking about that all the time and you sort of keep things in three dimensions. But this is just a pure play. You read the document and then you go find out what the financials look like, and it's pretty straightforward. You can, and I don't think there's anybody in this room who's not qualified to do that. If you know, want to put the work into it. It is 175 pages. It reads like a dream. It's like a novel I couldn't put down. So,
you know, they're both right, and I'm glad. You know, I used to say that I would get calls from people, especially on Meritor, I would get calls, and they would want you to tell them the story. Well, it takes an hour and a half to tell the story. So, you know, I would say, look, it's a 170-page opinion. Take it home with you for the weekend because you're not going to get it read in an hour. And come back, and when you come back, we'll have a quiz. All right? So don't ask me any more questions, because at first, if you ask me the wrong questions, I'm going to know you didn't study and do your homework. Well, these two guys did, believe me. And if you want to know the story, the place to go is grab that opinion. It'll tell you the whole history of the company, the how it got into the shape it's in, where it's going, and they're right. The judge. And by the way, this is at the Court of Appeals level. When you liquidate an insurance company in Pennsylvania, you just don't get some, circuit court judge to do it. That has to be approved by the Commonwealth Court, which is their equivalent of the Court of Appeals. And the judges up there are not slouches, and she is the former chief counsel to the...
But you had a point. You were going to make? I said I cut you off, but you had a point that you were...
Well, yes, go get the opinion and read it, and it'll tell you everything that you want or need to know.
So back to three-dimensional investing, which I think is a little bit...
It was four before.
Four-dimensional investing?
I thought it was three.
It's three-dimensional. Let's talk about, for a second, JCPenney and Sears. Leon was in two Sears stores yesterday and has an opinion on that, but let me just follow up on one of the comments I said this morning about JCPenney. The comp store sales were down 21.7% for the second quarter, and the traffic was down 12%. And they made this move from going from being promotional to everyday low pricing, which we've seen, you know, any number of executives come into the distressed retailers that we've been buying into all these years, and I've never seen one of those work. It's failed almost every time. And this new rocket scientist thinks that he's going to do this at JCPenney.
He came from where? Apple? Did he come?
Not sure, but it was Apple, right? Yeah. So my view would be you kind of stay away from this till after the Christmas results are disclosed, which will be disastrous, and then he'll get fired and the stock will rally. But that's my view. But what do you think about JCPenney or Sears? And then we can take some questions if there's time.
A few minutes about the history of Penny. You probably know a majority of it.
So skip that
it
part.
Was, you know,
get to the part they don't.
It's very interesting that the company hired a guy who was marketing technology company to redo a retail business, which completely different concept, different clientele, different people, and everything different about it. And interestingly enough, I compare this change to a Macy's and bankruptcy about, 15 years ago.
Federated
bankruptcy. Federated bankruptcy, when they brought a person who completely changed the old-fashioned way of doing business.
Federated was Bloomingdale's, by the way.
Alexander's is another one. Okay, let me just interrupt for one second. You know, and I thought of this today, Leon. Who's on the board of these companies? I mean, how many times have we just rattled off four examples. How many times have we seen this happen?
And they had time because the guy who was running it was excellent, and he had been there for 10 years or whatever. What's his name? I forget his name.
These directors, do they not know anything about people doing this before and how it blew up?
Is this a question?
Yeah.
I will answer.
All right.
He's sort of getting to that.
Because the one thing you should never do is follow the crowd. And they're sitting all in one room, and they bring a guy who is a really genius with many other components. The product was good. The timing was good.
You're talking about Apple. Right?
Everything was good. It was all, everything came to one point. And it's very seldom happened. The company went from $14 to
$600. So it was, in my opinion, a total disaster from day one. Because the concept, the philosophy, And the expense of redoing stores is enormous. And if you're going, starting, I think, in March, and going to the Christmas, where the highest sale occur, I thought at the time that this whole phenomena of changing the company to the new marketing style is ridiculous. And we have few pennies around when I leave, and I went and visit the stores, and they remodeled the stores while having sale, and sale continued to drop every single quarter because you couldn't find anything, because you have old merchandise and new merchandise. You have furniture on top of crystal, and it was good maybe idea, but it is a bad idea. They really want to compete with Macy's. He kind of probably went to Macy's stores, look of their new layouts, and try to modernize the stores. In the meantime, he lost all old customers. And this is my observation, I don't know. I also kind of compare those to the JCPenney a little bit now to Sears and Kmart, because the guy wants to go up. In the meantime, he went down. He changed all the merchandising, and Sears, in the meantime, I visited also over this weekend, two stores. They completely redone stores. They have a lot of inventory. The credit is probably available unless they're buying on cash. I don't know for sure. There is a stall full of merchandise, which is, if you go 6 months, yes, that's a good thing. That's what, if you walk 6 months ago, you didn't have that much merchandise in Sears stores. So if Lambert can pull it out and bring some new modern stuff and maintain the old customers, Sears may do something. In the meantime, he spins off all the other businesses. My opinion, he owns so much shares, I don't know what he's going to do with it, but he will probably sell this real estate at any price. And that's what the end of the story. But JCPenney, you are correct. You should wait and wait. Or if you buy the stock a little bit here, you sell calls against it every single month. Because what will happen here, I don't know. Macy's growing, and they're going down.
What's exciting about a JCPenney, I call it about it, and I know we got to go. We refer to it as like tracking a wounded bear. Every now and then, you got to kind of get your investments. You got to think about what you want to achieve, and then see if the wounded bear wanders in the woods and then lies down dead. Then you can go to approach it, right? But if you don't track it, you're not ever going to be ready for it when it collapses. So this is one of those that, you know, you don't want to buy it here at 17, but if you keep it, you might find it's there at $3, $4, $5, $6. This is the franchise is good, particularly when they change this new CEO and they get rid of him and bring in a guy who understands what JCPenney's has really been about. So I don't know if we have any more time, or Peter says no. So if there's any questions, if we have time for that. Yes, sir.
Would you short
pennies? I probably would at this point, yes, and particularly going into the Christmas season.
I think they're going to have it disastrous. You might also take a look at, and I'm not up to speed on it, but you might want to also take a look at the debt.
It still trades at par, close to it.
Yeah, it's at par. Yeah,
but if you get a good crack in the price of the debt, it might be.
Oh, you mean as a buy? Yeah, that's probably a buy. I mean, it's not a buy here because it will crack. I think it'll crack a good 90, but it's like a 102 or so. And I wouldn't short the debt because you got to pay the interest costs on it. So that's like
it's not going bankrupt yet.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Can somebody address what they think is going to happen with the NBIA situation? Mm-hmm.
I had followed that. I had shorted that a while ago, and I have been out of it for about 2 years. So it sounds like the momentum's going that way, but that's all I would know about it. Yes, sir.
Any thoughts on coal?
Coal. Well, I said this morning I would short it. I wonder if any of the guys, because I think in a regulatory environment, they're going to look to destroy it. Dave, you have a thought on that, or is it a regulatory environment?
Yeah, we haven't done anything recently in coal, but I generally agree with you.
You'd stay away from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. It's always a tough time.